So, Taoism is its history is interesting. So, it really comes out of the Kautsky end of the Espada, and that is the critique of the idea that there was no need for a party to kind of lead the working class out of unionism and into something else. It was an argument. It really gets concretized under Lenin, as many things that Kautsky thought get concretized under Lenin, even though Lenin often denies this, where you needed a vanguard party to think towards socialism, as opposed to just trying to deliver what the working class already wanted. Now, you and I have talked about kind of the dialectic that emerges here, and I think there is an internal dialectic to Taylorism. I mean, there is a sort of problem with both answers to it.
Well, let's stay with this question about leading the workers out of the trade unions and into a radical socialist project and socialist party. The question is whether or not the working class would arrive at its own political ambitions to overthrow the mode of production and develop socialism through its own political will, and whether or not it needed some new idea to be introduced to it before it could arrive at a socialist project. I mean, I may be restating it, but I just want to, like, it's a matter of almost a matter of education.
Yeah, I mean, with the Kautsky and Vanguard Party, and to some degree the Leninist formulation of the Vanguard Party, which, for a while, when you and I started, those were swear words. Now they're embraced by everybody. So how faddish we are, which becomes its own form of this problem. But Taylorism was a very specific kind of opportunism where you just kind of delivered to the working class what they wanted, but within a limited horizons of contemporary society, which would at the time have been like trade union or artisan union activism, guild unions, that sort of thing. The issue with that is that it's not very radical. But when the Vanguard Party emerges, it's like it's based off of this idea from Marx and Engels that the advanced parts of the proletariat, with an admixture of peoples who had the time from the proletarianized classes, so classes whose interests were with the proletariat and individuals who realized that the future interest was in the proletariat, would kind of form a political consciousness and develop the program as socialism was developing. Now, the Vanguard Party is of like a formal concretized form of that. And Marx doesn't write that much about party politics at all. Engels writes a little more about it, and a lot more about it in his letters with Kautsky, particularly the ones after Marx's, like very soon after Marx's death.
But both of them were invested in a Vanguard Party. It's just what should that party do was different, right? The Vanguard Party under Kautsky would be the party that would maybe administrate and set the policies towards reform and the gaining of power within bourgeois electoral system, maybe.
I mean, yeah, although I mean that's a, like we are making an opposition that actually is stronger in hindsight than was at the time, even between Lenin and Kautsky. Lenin sort of overplays this up. Kautsky never saw himself as a reformist until after 1914.
No, they both saw themselves as accepting the necessity of reform.
Right.
The question with Taylorism is not whether or not you need to have reforms in order to then get to a point where you can have a revolution. The question was the degree to which the party needed to take a leadership role and break with the legal structures of society as it was as well, in order to create a party that a political project that could be revolutionary and violent,
if need be, yes.
If need
I mean,
be.
Kautsky and honestly also Engels left open the possibility that the violent revolution would only be defensive and thus also legal, because they, like Engels and Kautsky, both believed would full enfranchisement of the population, since most of the population in the developed world would be proletariat, that in most places, particularly Germany, Engels had hesitations about England, and I could get into that later.
But I mean, if you're aiming at seizing the mode of production, right? That's either going to be through the state, in which case you can make it legal, or it's going to be an illegal act.
Right. Well, and they were open to both, but they thought that you could seize it democratically through the state. And then there would be an ensuing basically counter war. A counter revolution would be immediately incurred, and then the violence would probably happen that way. But it would probably happen either way, but they would prefer it to be defensive as opposed to offensive. Marx was actually really more open on that question, from what I can tell, the entire part of his life. Like, he just didn't really say.
And what we're talking about right now is something that both Lenin and Kautsky agreed about being eventually necessary. So then it really comes down to whether or not you believe that the working class is aiming in that direction on its own, or whether or not the Vanguard Party needs to find militants within the working class in order to lead the working class. And lead the working class towards an understanding of the limits of, say, demands for wages, or the limits for of other kinds of reformist projects, trade union sort of policies.
Right. To me, the difference is the development of this idea of the professional revolutionary.
Right.
Which are people who speak of who speak for the class, but are not of it because they have the time to devote to be nothing but revolutionaries.
Right. Like you and me, although more sure. me than you.
Yeah. what I was going to agree with
Chris
you, though,
Catrone
is the
original – is spinning in his grave right now, by the way, and he's not even dead yet. Go ahead.
Yeah. What I would say to that is the Vanguard Party's function under Kautsky in the time period that it was primarily educational, and then was in the – as it achieved democratic power, would become more and more as the arm or the brain of the dictatorship of the proletariat. It would be more and more administrative.
Right, right. Okay. So just to clarify one more time to reference Catrone again, in an earlier conversation with Catrone, an interview with Catrone, the question was, does the communist project, or do Marxists believe that the aim should be to convince the working class as a whole that their understanding of reality and the economic system is true? And Catrone said, absolutely not. There's no need to try to convince everyone of your ideology. What we have to do is create a political party that can lead through struggle.
That's a Leninist conception. Although, again, like, these words are, I hasten to say, used deliberately vaguely by all parties.
Yeah, because would Lenin believe that the aim should be to find workers and who are radicalized and militant, who can then lead the working class into a struggle that they would then, the whole totality of the working class would understand, you know, or did he not care about that?
I'm not sure he cared about that. Although, again, that's the part of the issue why this came up with Lukács, right? As Lukács is accused in History and Class Consciousness, particularly in his answer that how we know, you know, we could abandon every last bit of Marxism, but a vague notion of its methodology could be in question as long as the methodologies adhered to and the people doing the thinking are in the early forms of History and class consciousness, the Soviets, the workers' councils. In the later forms, it's the party, and he revises his statement.
Where did he say that, and what exactly did he mean in context? Because I remember reading History and Class Consciousness and not – I don't remember reading that line.
He doesn't say it's the party, but he does say in the essay we talked about, you know, things becoming self-aware, the consciousness being concretized by the Soviets. That's at the end of that one there. When he gets under fire and basically renounces the book, that's his line, is that he was wrong and that he should have focused more on the party. The Soviets were too, you know, that was too indicated in trade union consciousness. Now, okay, the issue with all this
just to clarify again. So what he was renouncing was his commitment to the Soviet form. And the commitment to the Soviet form had to do with his interpretation, not just of the methodology of Marx, but also to his categories or.
Right. Yeah, okay. Well, the categories had to do basically with how the working class could think for itself and how that would be manifested, you know, because the critique wasn't of his methodology. His critique was that he did that it was tailist and thus not.
So the critique was not that he said you could abandon all of Marx's categories as long as you hold on to his methodology, but that instead that he was tailist because he committed too thoroughly to an ultra-leftist commitment to the Soviet form.
Right, although it would have been ultra-leftist at the time because, frankly, when he was writing, that was the stance the Soviet Union was taking, and that was the stance of the Revolution of Hungary.
Right, I know, but retroactively, after the fact, it's sort of like, you know, you're too gung-ho for the party line in that moment, and you stated it too baldly, so that when the party line changes, now you're, you know, being erased from photographs with Stalin.
Bingo.
Okay.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
So he kind of revises his opinion on tailism, admits that parts of that are legitimate critique, and starts to pick up this Leninist line of thinking that all Leninists agree with, including the ultra-left ones. Okay, this includes Bordigist, etc., that the function of the party is the development of the program. So that actually in and of itself is both administrative and educational. Now, where the program comes from jumps all over the place depending on what kind of Leninist you are. And even if you're like a Marxist Leninist or a quote-unquote Stalinist, right, I'm using air quotes, that's not actually an answer either, because different Marxist Leninist groups, or particularly Marxist Leninist Maoist or Mao Zedong thoughters, and those are separate, weirdly. If you really look through the different kinds of Maoism and Marxist Leninism, they answer that question of what generates the program differently.
Right.
And so this issue gets more and more complicated throughout the first half of the 20th century. The other thing that's happening, and I talked a little bit about this, Mike McNair talks about this in his book Revolutionary Strategy, and part of what was frustrating Lenin, is the actual voting patterns of the working class and the actual party membership of the working class never left the Social Democrats. So when the Social Democrats were revolutionary in Germany, they had most of working class support. But when there's a split after 1914 and you have the left, you have one faction that really, you know, splits and joins up with what would become the Nazis. You have another faction, which is way larger, of the socialist right that splits and opposes the SPD and the communists. And then you have the Spartans and the Spartacist League and the German Communist Party, which emerge in, you know, the 1910s through the 1920s. And unfortunately, the Spartans and the Communist Party never really achieve popularity with the working class. Who joins them? Well, statistically speaking, it was the unemployed. Furthermore, in Russia and in China, you have an even bigger problem. And that problem is the peasantry is like 20 times larger, or maybe 200 times larger, actually, than the proletariat. So you don't have a large proletarian class to pull from.
Okay. Now, let me just state something that I think that, might need to be reiterated, which is that the question was not who could be more popular with the working class, but rather what was necessary in order for the working class to create socialism. Now, the assumption was that the working class could generate socialism.
Right. The working class is still the organ of generation of socialism.
Right. So the reason why it's important to determine who's popular with the working class is because that indicates whose understanding of the working class and their needs is going to lead to socialism.
Right. That's where the question of consciousness was so important to this. And there was a couple of different answers to this. One, there's the kind of Lenin, and even stated more emphatically in Bordiga, that the working class is not properly speaking a class until it has a political consciousness.
Right.
Which I know makes your brain hurt.
Yeah, well, it does a little bit, but I understand. But I think there's some assumptions there that run counter to some other ideas that might be in Marx. Like for instance, the fact that we have objectivized our ideology and that the ruling class under capitalism are actually alienated even from their own interests through the and servants of a particular form of productive life. And so if the working class really political, aren't really a class until they have a political aim, and an aim outside of to get up beyond capitalism, then almost it seems to me that by that standard, the bourgeoisie might not quite be a political class either. And in fact, Lukács might be saying something like that in his book, History and Class Consciousness, because the bourgeoisie doesn't truly fully have class consciousness.
Correct.
Right. So in that book. So, but the thing here that I want to underline is that in both cases, whether you're talking about the social democratic tendency that might associate with Kautsky or the more radical socialist Spartacist line that you would associate with Lenin, which is vanguardist and assumes you need a leadership to help the more militant working class people develop socialism, they both are thinking that the working class interests themselves will, when realized, and what realized means is sort of vague or might have two different meanings here, will be socialism. But the Leninists tend to think that they have a better understanding of what that will look like without any blueprints than the Kautsky side has. But what I wonder is, do they have different visions of what socialism actually is?
I would actually say no. I mean, to me, the major difference between the Kautskyan line of thinking and the Leninist line of thinking is where you think the important revolution was and whether or not it's in Germany or in the periphery.
So they weren't having fights over how they interpreted value theory.
No, I mean, honestly, the fight had to do with World War I.
Right.
And Kautsky sitting on his hand, all other fights were kind of post facto read onto that. But the general apparatus of value theory, of their ideas of what a party is, they were shared between Lenin and Kautsky. The attitude towards reformism was a little different. There were different attitudes about the min-max programs and that sort of thing, and the transitional program and this, that, and the other. Those are all different answers themselves. But how you really thought about the party and its function, that was shared between Kautsky and Lenin. They both, to me, have justification of Marx and Engels. Absolute justification, I'm not sure, because there are the other contradictions in it, like how much of the party should be non-proletarian and this, that, and the other. What should factions be like, etc. Those things aren't answered by these questions, and that's kind of an issue. But the bigger thing for me to focus on this is, why did the meaning of Taylorism change? And it actually is related to what I was mentioning earlier, which is that idea that social democrats were getting more of the vote of the working class while simultaneously not just becoming more interested in reforms, but becoming more reformist.
And by that you mean that as they achieve some of their goals, they no longer saw the necessity for a radical break in order to become something other than the capitalist society that they were in. But I think we need to say that a little bit more clearly, like what was Lukács' vision? What was Kautsky's vision of socialism when the workers actually got, you know, managed to produce it? And at some point it must have been that he thought that it could be achieved without, let's say, I don't know, seizing the means of production or overthrowing the wage form.
He didn't write about overthrowing the wage form because no one but Marx writes about overthrowing the wage form.
Right.
Okay, so let's get that. Like Lenin cares about it, but that's not even – I mean, no, and Lenin does write about it, I guess. But
even Stalin writes about it a little bit in a way, in a roundabout way, right?
But the understanding, the absolute insistence on it and how you got there is different. He did believe you had to change the means of production. What he was concerned with was that does come up, that is a little different than Marx and Engels, is he was concerned with the collapse of the bourgeois state leading to a sort of
– return of the autocratic.
The return of the autocratic state and the loss of gains. So like he was not like a Bernsteinist who was like a, you know, or a Fabian socialist. where he thought it was going to be a slow evolution. He didn't think that. He thought that a program had to be radically imposed, hopefully democratically, and that there would probably be violence involved, and that the working class would have to like seize the means of production and restructure its relationship to the workplace. But how it did that was more up for grabs.
Was it a matter of mostly of political control?
Yeah, it was a matter of political control. And his concerns for that, honestly, was the following. One, either the fallback to an autocratic state, or two, and this was, you see this in his critique of the general strike, which I, you know, I've mentioned many, many times in the past, I don't know, 6 years. He was afraid that in a war of attrition, the bourgeoisie wins because they have more stuff. So, you know, you have to seize fast. You have to seize thoroughly. You can't have things collapse so that people. So it's a sort of like rapid fire, democratic, massive reforms, and then restructuring of production, and then restructuring of the economy. I mean,
Of the economy, restructuring of production. But that restructuring
is largely a political project in Kautsky's mind. Yes.
Right. So from like the position of, I'm going to be talking to these people from Crisis Journal, mm-hmm. and, another journal called Exit. They're the value theorists in Germany. You know, they kind of feel like they're kin to Moshe Pistone. And from their perspective, all of these people were traditional Marxists in Pistone's sense, right? They all thought that the goal was to deliver the working class as the subject of history to political power, to be the new basis for production and exchange through the power of the state.
Right.
And that's Lenin, that's Kautsky, that's everybody.
Correct.
Bordiga, maybe not so much Bordiga, although maybe him too.
No, Bordiga thinks that too. I mean, Bordiga just thinks that like, don't confuse Bordiga and Bordigas with communization theorists, even though they cite Bordiga. I mean, like, even though I get criticized for this because I consider them both left communists, but Bordiga's proper, just think about an invariant program implemented by a party that is the brain of the proletariat, but the party doesn't necessarily have democratic mechanisms. It's organically centralist. It's kind of quasi-technocratic. And they don't. They actually reject the idea of transition periods for the most part. So most Bordigists have a soft critique, and some of them have an outright denial of the critique of the Goethe program. So that's where you kind of get stuck. But no, even Bordiga thought that the fundamental issue was the working class organizing itself as the organ of society. Now, the reason why things get more complicated, I think, with the actual historical communist parties is, like, from this theory's perspective, even if you have a vanguard party, the places with the most advanced proletariat should lead it. And where are the most advanced proletariat? The most advanced bourgeois countries, England and Germany. Now, Engels interjects something that kind of plays in this. Engels talks about the bourgeoisification of the English proletariat. And he also talks about labor aristocracy, although he means that in a different way. The Maoists mean it, but like that there is basically a tendency, since England got bourgeois society first and it's got the most advanced, but it has an empire, and it also has had a longer period of like agrarian capital, that its proletariat were largely bourgeoisified through the overripeness of capital there. But you can see how this theory becomes a problem, because basically that gets expanded from England to Germany to the United States. Like, basically all developed countries start being critiqued as having a bourgeoisified proletariat. And then you have, you know, third worldism and other things develop out of this kind of thrown off line, actually, that Engels had. But that was why they particularly thought that Germany was so important and not, I don't know, any developed capitalist country, England, the United States, France. So that was that issue. Now, if you're in Russia, you got a problem, because the proletariat, even in Moscow, is not the hugest sector of society. It's just not. So critiquing Taylorism, you know, which I think is fair, people are like, well, what's all this rambling about? But this will get us to this point. Critiquing Taylorism, which I think is fair, becomes doubly necessary because, one, you have the issue of in the developed countries, the advanced proletariat, which is supposed to make up the base of the Socialist Party, is not joining the Communist Party. And two, you don't have a large enough proletariat to justify that developmental status for yourself, yet you want to be claiming to lead and begin the revolution. And this is both the problems of Russia and China.
Yeah, I mean, this. I mean, there'd be two motives for abandoning the working class as the and moving to the subaltern or something like that. And one would be the fact that the working class might not be radical enough. It may have become reformist, or you don't see that it developing towards the desire for power, maybe. And the other is that they don't support you.
Right.
Right.
And the third is there's not enough of them.
Well, also in the nations that you're now turning to.
Right.
Right. I mean, because there would be enough of them in Germany.
Right. And there would be enough of them. Well, actually, in 1840, would there be enough of them worldwide? I mean, that's a good question.
Well, probably. In 1848, the question of, I mean, you know, they had not, all of this hadn't quite been developed yet, right?
Right.
I mean, in 1848, the difference between overthrowing the king and overthrowing capitalism was only vaguely understood, even by Marx.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, he understood it pretty fairly well. And a lot of people were socialists then, but, and you know, you could look to the levelers or something.
Are the French socialist tradition, which predates Marx by like 30 years, I mean, you right. know. Right. That's why Marx was inconsistent on using the term.
Yeah.
But so what interestingly, what happens out of this critique of Taylorism, though, is you have increasingly the party sending diktats. And the party also starts, even though weirdly from Lukács, they're supposed to be less dogmatic and methodologic, less dogmatic, more methodologically strict. But, you know, any conclusion of Marx can be abandoned, according to Lukács, just not the methodology, whatever that means, which you and I agree. You go back and listen to our Zero Squared episode on this, that's vague. But that brings us to another problem of all this, too, is the party can this concretize vanguard ideas and new syntheses all the time, kind of by fiat. And they don't really have to justify it. And that's what you start seeing. The definition of party changes, tactics, strategies, you know, whether or not the law of value is in operation in socialism changes, like big things change from tactical to strategic to definitional based off the idea that, well, you know, we don't really need either we're not wedded to Marx dogmatically, and we don't really need the working class to be on board for our ideas. We need to lead them to better ones. It's a fact, though, we can pretty much make shit up. Which, you know, like in the popular consciousness gets conflated with this idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat, which I don't think most Leninists would have understood themselves to be purely like no one really thought that like Stalin was the dictator of the proletariat, including Stalin himself. But the dictatorship of the proletariat is interesting, and you really have to, you know, Hal Draper has a good book on this, but I mean, I knew this before reading this book. You have to remember that dictatorship did not mean that Marx was writing out of a classical context, and dictatorship means the suspension of some constitutional norms so that the republic can be maintained. That's what a dictatorship means. It actually doesn't mean the assumption of power totally.
Like becoming Napoleon.
Right. But the idea is like you have a dictator, a Sulla or a Caesar to save the republic under crisis.
Right. But you don't have that. You have the proletariat doing that job instead.
Right. In Marx, the proletariat, basically during the period of reorganization, the proletariat and thus classes that it wants to get a vote. And until there are no in order so there can be no classes. But by that, he does not oppose to killing some people, but he doesn't really mean like just physically killing everybody.
Does he even mean that only the people who are officially within the working class will be able to participate democratically in parliament?
He basically means that like, the sovereign exception belongs to the proletariat as a class.
Right, rather than the president or the dictator or whatever it would be. Right. So, like, it'd be like Theresa May can't just push Brexit through. In order to do something like that, you'd have to have the vote of the people, the dictatorship of the people.
Right. But this would be a dictatorship of the proletariat. So it's a certain class. So what that's designed to do is stop the political rigging towards the bourgeoisie.
Right. Where you have this representational government where they can pass laws and make things happen in the interest of capital.
Right, because things require funding and taxes and all that. So you have to exclude them from the system until they are sufficiently proletarianized. That was the idea. Right? It is not, you know, one dude speaks for proletariat, kicks everyone's ass, suspends all. So all these things get conflated. And the other reason they get conflated, and it's kind of obvious, is in both China and in Russia, you have massive civil wars. So, which is literally what the dictatorships were for. Like, historically in Rome, the reason why you have dictatorships is because the crisis has gotten so bad you're about to be at, or you are at, social or civil war.
Right. So, back to Taylorism. Taylorism changed in its meaning to a point where today, when the people I hear talk about Taylorism are talking about tailing the bourgeois parties, or tailing, like, the Democratic Party, or tailing the right. Labor Party. Like, we have Marxist groups that are no longer trying to lead the workers, but are now just trying to influence the Democratic Party, which is now leading the workers in the United States.
So I think that is really interesting, because it betrays conflating it to the U.S. is weird. The reason why is, at least with the Labor Party or the SPD in Germany, or the Social Democratic parties
in Sweden,
is they start off as actual labor parties. You know, they're actually parties of labor. A lot of them have real Marxist origins. Some of them don't lose them till very, very late. I mean, in the case of Sweden and Norway, you're talking like the 70s is when they really start backing away from that. The issue is that because of the association historically with the SPD, with kind of tailing the working class to keep their ranks up, according to the Leninist parties, they got seen as being tailist. Well, as those parties lost working class affiliation, and depending on where you're at, that I mean, like, arguably, for example, labor didn't really lose it till the end of the Blairite period. It began to mean just the party of, quote unquote, the parliamentary or reformist or capitalist left, and then following that, even though what had happened in the interim, particularly since the 60s, is the working class is increasingly just entirely depoliticized. You're not tailing the working class anymore. You're tailing the parties that historically represented them, except in the case of the United States, where there has never been a party that historically represented the working class, ever.
So how does the accusation of tailism, or let's say the reality of Taylorism, because I do think there's some truth to the idea that the Marxist left, such that it exists in the United States, but even in the UK or other places, Sweden, wherever, what they do is they try to propagandize the working class through the more mainstream social democratic parties, right?
So, yeah. So the other issue, and the thing that we haven't, the third factor that really plays into this and makes this really confusing, is the United Front strategy and the Pop Front strategy. I mean, these could arguably be their own episodes, and maybe they will be, but the United Front strategy has a complicated history and changed meanings a lot. But the idea was that socialists in crisis could enter parliamentary governments with bourgeois parties of the left or even of capital to fight a reactionary threat or a return to autarkic rule or like a reactionary form of capitalism taking over or say slavery or whatever with critical support. Or they would have tactical allegiances. They would vote for the tactical stuff but not support they would not support their candidates. All right. Or they would critically support their actions but not their candidates. Okay, fine. After third periodism and the hostility between Stalinism and social democracy died down a bit. Remember, in third periodism, I mean, they were Stalin was calling social democrats social fascist. And as a side note, that isn't as quite as much of a stretch as we'd like to pretend it was. But historically speaking, that's a little bit vague. So after that, he introduced the Pop Front strategy. Then that largely just comes from like cynical attempts to oppose fascists, sometimes half-assedly. So you would hide your position in regards to nationalist parties. This was also adopted by Maoists, specifically because the Maoists needed to work with nationalists in their kind of third world alignment movement. And that goes all the way back to their own history, where they were encouraged by Stalin to side with the nationalists. And also Sun Yat-sen was sympathetic to both the nationalists and the communist cause. Now, and there are good reasons for that. I don't want to make it sound like it was totally cynical, but that...
Well, I mean, the thing about that is that's not that different if you think about it. At least it sounds similar to how even in 1848, the socialists and the nationalists were aligned.
Right. And you're also talking about areas that were, you know, like economically, developmentally kind of not that different from 1848, even though it was 100 years later.
Right.
So it's not crazy. But the issue that you really get into, I think, and why we kind of associate Taylorism with that now, is the Pop Front kind of obliterated the difference between the labor parties, the progressive bourgeois parties, and the idea of like critical support or front support from communists. And what made it even weirder is by the time you get to the 1970s and 80s, the Soviet Union is still an active player in this stuff, but is beginning to decline in its interest in like supporting weird sects in America. And so they start trying to like preemptively do prop front strategies and stuff. And that becomes a big divider. Well, in all this time, Taylorism's just moving with it. So first Taylorism is tailing the working class uncritically and just providing them what they want. Then it's doing that in a party form. Then it's, we have to make coalitions with these parties to fight whatever.
With these other parties, with the bourgeois parties.
Yeah, with these other parties to fight whatever. So keep your mouth shut, because it's tactical. And then it becomes, well, we got to do this to get power. Let's follow the parties. And during this time period, the working class is progressively less and less of a politicized mass movement, particularly in the most developed parts of capitalism, Germany, France, the United States, and England.
Right. Yeah. And that's an institutional change.
Correct.
In those places. It's not just a matter of the working class consciousness. It's not that there are people who are watching TV.
You know, it's that too, but it is also an institutional change. Like, there's just less and less working class representation. And, you know, in America, this is particularly obscured by the New Deal, which either saved, you know, American welfare statism, you know, and birthed something like socialism, or also killed it at the same time. You know, like depending on who you ask, what, you know, it may have inspired Americans like social democracy, you know, our democratic socialist impulse, which I don't believe, or it would, you know, put down a socialist threat by compromise. But that compromise was eventually supported by the Pop Front, which means it had the Communist Party, you know, imperator on it, which is kind of an issue. And that's how what we're tailing moves.
But it seems to me that today, one of the problems that we're dealing with is that the original aim that Kautsky and Lenin held in common, which is that the working class has a task of creating socialism.
Right. Whether or not we tail it is not the issue. That's been dropped. Right?
Yeah. No one really holds that anymore. And even the communists don't even hold that anymore. Exactly.
Right. Which is why this Taylorism leads to what I like to call the universal Bonapartist theory. So this is me saying, like, you'll notice that there's a bigger and bigger focus for not just in MLs, you know, you have the cult of personality, which is its own problem, but there's a bigger, bigger focus on not just the bourgeois state, but literally the executive. And the more Taylorist you are, the more you focus on the executive.
Right. Whereas in the United States, I mean, everyone is mega Taylorist, and that's why they're so focused on.
Right. So all we really care about is Bernie Sanders. And I'm not critiquing Bernie for this. All right.
Right.
This is not Bernie's fault. This is our fault. We're not looking at building a movement. Even if we wanted Bernie Sanders' democratic revolution to be a thing, you don't see enough movement to build the legislative and state and city and municipal power across the country, even in rural areas, for the Bonapartist stuff to be really effective. So instead of starting with building that up, which would, you know, if you thought about something organically emerging from like a class, it would be easier for the politics to emerge at the local level. We start at the very top and hope for it to be imposed. So in this weird way, we're tailing the major parties, hoping that they will impose the conditions for maybe kind of a party to maybe kind of lead the proletariat if we care about the proletariat, but we don't even define it.
And so, when you talk on this level, you're not even addressing some of the more fundamental problems, which are like, let's say that we did have a local movement where so that on the local, we did have a broad movement so that in Congress and the Senate and in the governorships and in the local, you know, state congresses, that we had enough Sanderite democratic socialists that his agenda could be given political legs.
Yeah, real political legs. Yeah.
Real political legs. We would still run up against the problem of the economy itself.
Right. Right. We haven't dealt with the what you and I would call the value theoretic and what everyone else would call the economic problem. And so in this weird way that economism and political determinism like switch back and forth into each other, like we've been talking about that for years too, right? This happens here with Taylorism. So what?
Well, but I want to point out something about economism because the original meaning of that word is totally different. I get accused of it all the time, but I'm nothing. I'm nowhere near that. I'm not at all an economist in that sense.
Define economistic as you would define it. I actually don't think you're an economist either.
The original accusation of those who are holding with economism is that they felt that the workings out of the capitalist system itself would lead to socialism.
Correct. So they are basically Bernsteinist.
Yes.
Right.
That is the charge. It's the charge that we need do nothing politically, really, that we just need to support the most progressive aspects of capitalism, maybe, and it will bring us to, I don't know how, I need probably to read Bernstein.
Bernstein just thinks it'll happen by evolution, literally.
Right. Yeah.
Now the other theorists were like that will heighten the contradictions to the point where there will have to be a general strike.
It's like accelerationists might be economistic.
Yes, they would be.
But weird is they're economistic because they don't have a theory of the economy.
Right.
You know, they just.
Well, a lot of times people who are politically determinists don't have a real viable theory of politics either. So
that's true, too. But, you know, what we really should say, I think the way that's really manifest today is not as economism, but as techno fetishism.
Yeah. So fully automated luxury communism without a revolution. Paul Mason and Bastani and those guys.
Yeah, they think that that's capitalism delivering the technological solution through innovation of the means of production for socialism to arrive.
And all we have to do is politically manage it.
All we have to do is politically manage it with or without the support of the working class people, because you can't really trust them half the time. They're racist. So,
right.
You get this technological utopianism even in Varoufakis.
Right. Which to be fair, to me, that's pre-Marxist socialism.
Yeah. I actually think that of all the tendencies, that may be the most hopeful one. You know,
pre-Marxist socialism have the debates that you had in the Enlightenment. And by the Enlightenment here, I mean like early, way before 1848, about whether or not you needed enlightened despotism or democracy. The radical versus the aristocratic enlightenment. You know, Voltaire sides with, you know, with like enlightened despotism because it's going to take too long to educate the masses. Well, okay, that theory, even though it, you know, gets superimposed modernly, weirdly, onto Marxist debates, and they get conflated, I think. I think that's what's going on there. So you have these pre-Marxist conceptions being read onto Marxism with our current understanding of technology, but like kind of. I mean, the thing about me with Mia, with a lot of the common economistic, like evolvist or accelerationist or whatever, they're different forms of them, is that I don't really know what they think socialism is other than like people have stuff and maybe we work less.
Well, yeah. I mean, socialism is the overcoming of the problems that arrive of basically inequality and violence and conflict.
They don't tend to have productive. Now, not that Marx was completely consistent, even himself on his definitions of class, but they don't tend to have productive theories of class. They tend to have
social theories of class,
social demographic income theories of class.
Right.
Right. So yeah. Which to me, like social theory, social classes, like social theories of class is maybe true. That doesn't explain the primary contradiction of capitalism though. And when we say class, we mean something else. When I say class in a Marxist context versus when I'm talking about like middle class and upper class and lower class into like, I don't know, normies, I mean different things, radically different things. They're not like synonyms for one another.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, one of the problems that we're – it seems to me – maybe I have a false sense of security here. It seems to me as you go through the history of socialism, you get some clarity on these issues. I mean, you don't have a solution, but you do get some clarity.
You see the problem and you see how the problem got worse. Like you can see how historically speaking, like through a series of some of it deliberate moves and some of it frankly just kind of stochastic accidents, these things get more and more associated. But we're not questioning that. Because like people throw, like you said with Taylorism, they throw it around, but they don't really they know it because they've heard it used once. Like they don't really know the history of how it developed, which is kind of almost an etymological or textual history. And then they don't know all the context for all of that.
Right. And look, and I don't even blame people for that because, you know, you asked me in 2 weeks, you know, to go through all the lexicon. I may forget, you know, and as I get older, it's going to get over even worse. Right.
But it gets hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the lexicon expands.
Right.
Changes and evolves. And B, it's really complicated how some of these concepts are used, you know, even if we were able to keep them in their pristine moment in time.
This is why I emphasize value.
Thank you for listening to Pop the Left. We'd like to thank our producer, Toby Keemer, and everyone at Zero Books for supporting the podcast. Please contribute to the Zero Books Patreon to keep us going and to hear additional episodes.